Thank you, band. That was awesome. It's a great way to start this service. Good morning. My name is Paul. I'm one of the teaching pastors here. And I want to start with a little divide the room kind of question. All right, this is kind of a separating the sheep and the goats type thing. How many of you out there remember the Apple IIe? This side's very quiet. Yeah, the college, okay. Yeah, about the same as first service. I was thinking a little less, maybe. The Apple IIe was one of the first real computers you could buy and have in your home. And I remember as a kid wanting the Apple IIe. I remember the first time we as a family got a computer. You know, today we carry around these fabulously powerful computers in our pockets, but as a kid we were deprived of these things, right? They just didn't exist. But I wanted one. And I remember asking for one for Christmas. My older brother, my older sister, and I, we were hoping for this, and we did what you're not supposed to do in December. We went looking around the house. And we found it in the attic, like 17 boxes worth, because that's how many it took to house one computer, covered in a sheet. And we knew we were going to get a computer for Christmas. And we waited for it. We longed for it. My brother was excited. My sister was excited. But I was like, excited doesn't begin to describe it. I could not wait. And there was something about knowing that it was there that in a sense made waiting harder. Because I knew it's there. It's in my house. If I could just open it now. But there's another sense where waiting, you know, knowing it was there made waiting a little bit easier. So I remember thinking as a kid, all I got to do is survive a few more weeks, you know? If I could just stay alive, Christmas will be like, that's a low bar. That's all I have to do. And I know for sure that I'm going to get this computer. And all my hopes and dreams will be met. Do you know that feeling when you want something really badly? And you think, when I get this, oh, it's going to be great. You know, maybe it's a job, maybe it's the weekend, maybe it's a vacation, maybe it's a spouse or a child or a grandchild or retirement or something. You just think, you know, when that day arrives, things are going to be different. What if I told you that you could have it? What if I told you that it's there, that thing you've always wanted is available to you? It's in some boxes in your attic. Waiting for the day to be revealed. We're very close to wrapping up this series in the book of Revelation that we've been doing. We've called it Wake Up because our hope is that these visions would open our eyes to a spiritual reality that we're not always aware of. And we've seen a lot as we've gone through the book of Revelation. We've seen letters written to churches. We've seen the vision of God in his throne room. We've seen judgments on the world. And most recently, we've seen judgments on Satan, on the beast, and all the evil forces that are at work. But all of that, all of the things in the book have been preparation for something new. God has been clearing the way of old stuff to bring about something new. And today, finally, today, we get to read about what's new. And we open up Revelation 21, and we see what God's been working towards. And I think what we'll recognize is that this vision describes a picture of what we've always wanted. Last week, Scott walked us through Revelation 20. We saw the final battle with Satan and the beast. We saw them thrown into the lake of fire forever, along with all those who would follow their evil ways. And with that scene, God's final work of defeating evil was completed, paving the way for this. And as we get to Revelation 21, we're going to see all these threads throughout the book of Revelation, all of which meet, they find their goal, their conclusion in this scene. Revelation 21 and 22, these two chapters are the grand conclusion to the whole book. But even more than that, we're going to find that as we look at these two chapters, we'll see they're the grand conclusion to the whole biblical story. That what began in Genesis and worked its way through God's people in the Old Testament, Jesus' first coming and the Gospels and then the church in the New Testament, that all of that lands, all of that concludes here in Revelation 21 and 22. But more than that, I think what we're going to find is that there's something in our hearts something in our stories, whatever God has done in our lives, where we've been, where we've come from, what we've done, that lands in these chapters too, that it's our conclusion. And I hope we're going to see that this conclusion, the conclusion of Revelation, of the Bible, of our lives, that the end that we see here is actually not an end at all, but it's a beginning of an entirely different sort, of an entirely different kind of experience, much greater and grander than we can even put our fingers on. I remember distinctly the feeling I had when I graduated college, and I'm thinking of our college students here, and remember thinking that when that moment came, the future just seemed like it opened up wide. So I remember thinking everything up to that point had been deciding among a set of choices. And those were hard choices, but which classes to take, which major to focus on, which school to go to, what, you know, all these things. But then when you graduate college, it's like there's no set of choices. It's just the world. And where do you live and where do you work and who do you spend your time with? And it's like this openness of a type that I had never experienced in life. And I think that can help us to grasp this scene where now all of history, all of our experience opens up into something new, a type of experience that we've never really known before. Something altogether different. And yet familiar, because we recognize it as something we desire. That's my prayer this morning as I've been preparing this passage, is that when we encounter this vision, as we read these words, we'll recognize it. We'll recognize that this is what lies in my heart, that this is what I've been longing for, and that recognition, that connection between our hearts and this vision will allow God to work somehow in our lives. Let's pray as we begin. God, I'm grateful for this text, for this whole book of Revelation, for the way that you have so powerfully, beautifully portrayed your work in the world, your fervent passion to see evil defeated and good victorious, to see your people freed, to see the world living as it was meant to be. And God, as we come to this chapter, I pray you'd help us to encounter it, to open our hearts, to see it with your eyes, that we would wake up to this reality and to see that this is something within us that lies before us. It can only happen through your Spirit, God, through your working in our hearts and through the various emotions and stories and histories that we come in here with, but we ask you to do that. In the name of Jesus, help us to see. Amen. Well, the world has been cleared of all evil when we get to Revelation 21. God's work of judgment is done, and now we get to see this new thing. We're going to start by reading Revelation 21, verses 1 to 4. John says, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away.'" The Bible begins in Genesis 1:1 with these words, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." Now, at the conclusion of that story, we read these words, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth." And we realize that the first couple chapters of Genesis where God's creation was described and these last few chapters of Revelation 21, 22 are mirrors of each other in some way. That in Genesis we saw God creating the world. And then he created man and woman and he gave them a calling to live as his servants, stewards over his creation. But then their crime separated them from God and brought in a whole host of consequences that they would live under. And finally, because of that, because The life of perfection that God had designed had been broken. God cast them out from that garden to live apart from his original intention. And the whole rest of the biblical story has been God's effort to try to repair and restore what he intended in Genesis 1. And so he tried all these different things. He selected a people. He gave them land. He put a king over them. He gave them law. He rescued them. He took care of them. And eventually God's people realized none of those things were it. None of those things worked. They didn't meet the needs that they felt inside. And so the prophets, after long years, the prophets of Israel started dreaming of something different, something altogether new. And so the prophet Isaiah would say this in Isaiah 65, verse 17. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. The prophets thought, what was in the past wasn't good enough. Everything we could think of has been tried. But maybe God's got something we can't even imagine, something new. And when we get to Revelation 21, we see just that longing, those hopes, we see them fulfilled. We see the new creation in parallel with the first creation. We see a new calling given to men and women to live in the presence of God. We see that the original crime is gone. There are no more criminals. That the consequences for those sins, death and pain and suffering, have vanished. And that paradise that God's people have been cast out of, they've now been welcomed into to live in for eternity. Thousands of years of biblical and human history converge in this scene. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. What do those words do for you? What do they unlock within you? How do you react to them? And I think Christians in our world today are viewed a certain way. People have problems. They think Christians are hypocritical. They think that the system doesn't make sense. They may have problems with political or social stands that Christians make. They may have had experience with faith that didn't work out for them. But I think these words, if you start here, a new heaven and a new earth, it gets inside really quickly. It resonates with even people that have no interest in God or faith or anything. What do you want? What is it that you long for? What is it that you think might make things better? What is this whole thing about? What is life meant for? What's driving you? Listen to what C.S. Lewis, the author, suggests. He says, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there is such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there is such a thing as water. Men feel sexual desire. Well, there is such a thing as sex. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. See, there is this thing within us. It's almost as if like God has placed something within me that longs for something, but I can't quite understand it. And yet this vision of no more pain, no more suffering, no more tears, I recognize it. It connects somehow. And so my first invitation to us this morning is simply to listen to that thing in our hearts, listen to what is within us, listen to your desires. Ask the question where they might lead. There's so much that I want in life. I want to enjoy good food. I want to have fun. I want to live life to the full. I want to savor the intimacy of sex. I want to enjoy the companionship of friends and activities. I want to live in peace. I want to avoid pain and have joy. There's so many things that I want, so many just natural things. I want a new house. I want a new car. I want a new refrigerator that keeps things actually cold. But when I look at those things, what I realize is I don't really just want those things because I've gotten those things. I've had those things, but there's something else. There's something more. None of them really gets at that thing in my heart. It's as if maybe they point, those desires for certain things, maybe those desires point me elsewhere. Solomon was a king of Israel who had everything, all he could imagine. He knew something about the disappointment of getting what you want. He said this, made an observation about the human heart. Listen to Ecclesiastes 3:11. He said, "Also he," speaking of God, "has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end." It's a really curious phrase. It's almost as if God hid something within us that we feel that we're aware of, but we can't totally understand it. Solomon says, so that you can't quite grasp it. There's eternity there, but it's not exactly something we can totally understand. But then we read this picture of a vision of eternity where God is the beginning and the end, and maybe we're seeing that. Maybe this vision is the eternity that Solomon spoke of. There was another scene shortly after Jesus died and rose again. This was before his resurrection was widely known. And so some of his followers were traveling from Jerusalem to Emmaus. And Jesus, kind of sneakily, comes up beside them and starts walking with them. They don't recognize him, and he starts talking with them, asking about how their day is going. And they talk about the events, and Jesus explains to them the Old Testament. It says that he explained in the scriptures how everything points to him. And listen to what they observed, these two travelers. This is Luke 24:32. They said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" And so Jesus takes the Old Testament, takes the scriptures, and he tells them, this points to me. He's showing them the fulfillment of prophecy. He's opening their eyes to God's plan, and something burns in their hearts. I think it might be that eternity that Solomon was talking about, that they recognize this is in us, and we don't fully understand it, but it's burning there. Could these words be the same thing for us? "He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away." Do your hearts burn when you hear those words? When you think of a father wiping away your tears? When you think of a world where there's no more hurt, where there's no more death, where all the problems that assail us every day are gone? Doesn't something burn within you? Could that be the eternity that God's hidden there, awakened by this vision? As the passage continues, we get a vision of the kind of God who would do this, the kind of God who is at work, the kind of God whose presence we will live in for eternity. In the next several verses, we have seven statements that come from the throne of God. The first four are about God himself. The second three are about people. And so we'll start by reading these first four statements. This is Revelation 21, starting verse 5. "And he who was seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' Also he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.' And he said to me, 'It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end.'" Four statements that God makes from the throne. And as I've been studying this passage, preparing for this sermon, these first words have been haunting me. Haunting in a good sense. The words I just can't get out of my head. "Behold, I am making all things new." It's said in the present tense. This is something God is doing. He is making all things new. He doesn't say, "I have made all things new and here's the new thing." He says, "I am doing this. I am making all things new," continually, over and over again. And the continual nature of that phrase stands in sharp contrast to the definitive one-time action that God also says, "It is done." And we realize that in history, in time, God will do something. He did something when Jesus came the first time. He'll do something again, some grand cataclysmic event, but that one-time event will give way to a continual process of things being made new over and over again. This is who God is. He is the kind of God who makes things new. Jesus hinted at this in his ministry. He told a story, tried to get people to understand. This is in Mark 2, verse 21 to 22. Listen to his example. He says, "No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed, and so are the skins. But new wine is for fresh wineskins." Jesus came on the earth to say, "I am the kind of God, I represent the kind of God who makes things new." Think about that. Nothing in our experience, nothing we create, nothing we touch, nothing we've seen, nothing we've ever known of gets newer. We simply don't have a category for that. It's just, by definition, something begins and it gets older all the time, always. And yet here God is saying, "I make things new." What is that like? My computer gets slower. My phone gets older. My house falls apart. My body stops working. Everything decays. Everything gets older. And this highlights one of the basic problems we face as humans: time. The passage of time. What do we do about it? We fight against it. When we're young, we think, "Oh, if I'm only older." When we're old, we think, "Oh, if I'm only younger." And we're middle-aged, we're just confused because we don't know what to think. And I don't know whether I want to be older or younger. I don't like this, but that, I don't know. How do you control time? You can't. It just happens. And sometimes we're thankful for it. Sometimes we're fighting against it. But God does things outside of time. He makes things new. Always. And when I think about that, something within me settles. Because I want to control stuff. I want to manipulate time. I want to manage. I want to work hard. I want to make sure things happen. And then when I think about the God who always makes new, I think, okay, I can rest in that. I can sit back and trust that kind of a God to work in my life. I think that's what our desires point to. They point us to this God who makes new things so that we can rest in him, so that we can let God make things new. I was trying to understand time to prepare for this message, and so I had called up one of the guys in the church who's a physicist at Stanford and said, "Can you give me a brief primer on how physicists view time?" And he said, "Sure," and that was the last word I understood for the next 20 minutes or so. But mostly what I grasped was how complicated things are. And he said this thing that helped me. He said, "The human mind is best equipped to understand medium-sized things." He said, "We can see the things that occupy our world really clearly. We can grasp those kinds of things. Our mind is designed almost to grasp those things. But when we start to try to think about the very large, which physicists study on the cosmological level, or the very small, which physicists try to study on the quantum level, it gets really hard," which explains why I didn't understand any of the words. "It's almost as if we're fighting against our very nature, and we can do it, but our math has to change, and our models has to change, and our minds have to stretch to grasp these things that are outside of our experience." And that helps me to see that when we get to Revelation 21 and we hear about a God who is the beginning and the end, who is older than anything that's ever been ancient and newer than the newest thing we've ever experienced, that this kind of God is not a medium-sized thing. This God is bigger and smaller and older and newer than anything we've known, and so we encounter him. We long for it, but there's something about this God that we can't quite get our minds around, even as we want to. Honestly, I don't totally understand a God like this. I can't get my mind around him. But I know it's what I want. I know that I'm tired of the old things. I'm tired of death. I'm tired of mourning. I'm tired of tears. I'm tired of a world where those things hold sway. I want something new. I want the former things to pass away and this newness to arrive. And when I look at my life, when I ask God, what are you doing? I see God doing this. I see God making new in me. That I see God opening up new ways of relating to him. New ways of reading the text. I see in my marriage, God, after 20 years, opening up new ways of relating to each other. I see in our church, after a 70-year history, newness coming about in our world. And I recognize God's fingerprints in that. God is the God who makes new. As the apostle said, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. Behold, I am making all things new. So how do we get there? If this is what God is doing and this is the kind of God who does this, how do we react? What's left for us? Well, as I said, the first four statements are focused on God, but these last three are focused on people. So God says this then at the end. He says, to the thirsty, I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. And so the passage concludes with a description of two paths. Two different ways to describe people on the first path and a whole list describing people on the second path. That second path ends with death, the second death, what has been referred to throughout Revelation as the last chance, the final turning away from a God who loves his creation. But let's look at those phrases. The first phrase is that the thirsty are the ones who will drink from the water of life. And I love that description of the followers of God, that God's people are first and foremost the ones who thirst, that we long for something. It's taken from an Old Testament prophet. Isaiah, again, speaks this in Isaiah 55, verse 1. This invitation, come, everyone who thirsts, come to the waters. And he who has no money, come, buy and eat. Come, buy wine and milk without money. And without price. It's the thirsty. The thirsty are the ones who experience God. This is what we've been saying all along, that this thing within us, this desire that's buried within us, when we open it up, when we recognize it and see that it points to God, when we embrace our thirst, we'll see God. But followers of Jesus are also described here as the ones who conquer. And my first reaction is, you know, thirsting is a lot easier than conquering. Conquering sounds like a lot of work. I'm not sure I'm up for that. But if we read Revelation and we read that phrase, we've seen that phrase before. In fact, it's come up in all the letters. In the letters, Jesus said, to the one who conquers, I will give this. To the one who conquers, I will give that. And John himself, the author of this book, in a previous book, 1 John 5, defines that term for us. Listen to verse 5 in 1 John 5. He says, who is it that overcomes the world? That's the same word there for conquer, except the one who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. So conquering, the one who conquers, is simply the one who believes, who puts their faith in Jesus as the one who conquers, even if it's a small faith, even if it's a weak faith, full of doubts and questions. Our faith is tied to the one who conquers. It's not tied to our ability to conquer at all. The alternative between thirsting and conquering is given this list of qualities, but it's the beginning and the end that really bookend it, the cowardly and the liars. The cowardly are the ones who see truth, who see what could be, but shrink back, take the easy way out. Decide it's not worth it in the end. And the liars are those who know the truth, have seen it, but decide to propagate other versions of reality, choose to live in line with a different world. And the funny thing about those phrases, the cowardly and the liars, is that I think those are the charges that people often levy against Christians. They say Christians take the easy way out. They just believe in this God that loves them, and that makes everything better. And Christians ignore science and reality and all this stuff, and they believe these lies. But here it said, no, not at all. That the path of faith in Christ, that's the path of courage and truth, of seeing what is unseen, of choosing to live your life in line with that. And it's the ones who Revelation warns people not to give up, not to lose courage, not to believe the lies. Because it's the cowardly and the ones who get overcome by the falsehoods of the world, those are the ones who don't taste the glory that God offers. So what do? It's just what we've been saying. We thirst and we believe. Thirst and believe. Don't give up. That's the main point of this book of Revelation. It's written to a church being persecuted with pressures on them. And it reminds them to just stay faithful. Recognize that eternity in your hearts. Recognize that this vision opens something up within you and stay faithful to it. Believe in it. We are all of us thirsty creatures. We have these desires, and often I think Christians get this wrong. We recognize that our desires, that those things we want, they can lead us in bad ways. And so we try to stifle them. We try to control them. We try to hide them. Don't think about money. Don't want that thing. Don't think about sex. Try to be good. Do this. And we take those desires. We take even that eternity in our hearts and we crowd it down because we're afraid of it. And then we wonder, why does God seem distant? Why does faith seem irrelevant? Why does life just seem monotonous? Because maybe we've not let ourselves thirst for what we were intended to thirst for. And when we allow those desires to come out, when we say, I think I want this new refrigerator, but I realize what I really want is a new heaven and a new earth. Things will be cold there automatically, right? I mean, you won't need a fridge. This is what I recognize in my heart. And if I allow myself to thirst, then the world opens up. I can experience this vitality with God, this relationship with Jesus who works in my life, who makes things new now, but who I know will make things new in a greater way that I can hardly understand in the future. Maybe this vision can release something for us, can wake us up to what we really want. This is worth waiting for. This is worth being patient for. As a kid, I wanted that computer so badly. I just knew when I got that computer, oh man, everything was going to be great. The excitement and the anticipation. I was waiting for this day, for a Christmas, the day that celebrates Jesus' first arrival. I thought, if I can just get to that day, it'll be great. And I did. I got to that day. I lived long enough. I survived. And it was glorious. The Apple IIe could do very small things now in comparison. But at the time, it could do amazing things. And I loved it. Until I didn't. And it got old and boring and faded away. But maybe in that, maybe God was trying to show me something about my desires and about what I really want. Maybe even now, maybe that's what God's been trying to show me all along, is teach me about my heart, teach me about what I really want. And so now I see this vision and I realize this is what I want. This is what I want. I want the new creation. I want it so badly that it burns in my heart, that every one of my desires points ultimately to this. And we've been shown it. We've been invited by God to say, come up and look at this thing. Go into the attic and see the new heavens and the new earth. Jesus says, I go there to prepare it for you. We've seen it and we know that it's coming. And all we have to do is wait. Not for Christmas, not for the day that celebrates Jesus' first arrival, but we wait for Jesus' second arrival. Patiently, hoping, anticipating, longing for that day to arrive, knowing that when it does, It actually will be glorious. And it won't get old. And it'll do things we can't even begin to comprehend. And life will be so full and rich that we'll recognize that is what we were created for all along. Next week, we'll see more about the city of the New Jerusalem, the place where we'll live, the kinds of people we'll live among, and we'll realize how God created us for that life from the beginning that we'll taste in the new heavens and the new earth. For now, can you see it? Can you see that vision? Can you recognize it as the eternity in your hearts? Can you wait? Thirst and believe and wait, for it's worth it. Amen.